The Mansion by Henry Van Dyke. There was an air of calm and reserved opulence about the Waitman Mansion that spoke not of money squandered, but of wealth prudently applied. Standing on a corner of the avenue, no longer fashionable for residents, it looked upon the swelling tide of business with an expression of complacency and half-disdain. The house was not beautiful. There was nothing in its straight front of chocolate-colored stone, its heavy cornices, its broad, staring windows of plate glass, its carved and bronze-bedecked mahogany doors at the top of the wide stoop, to charm the eye or fascinate the imagination. But it was eminently respectable, and in its way imposing. It seemed to say that the glittering shops of the jewelers, the milliners, the confectioners, the florists, the picture dealers, the furriers, the makers of rare and costly antiquities, retail traders in the luxuries of life, were beneath the notice of a house that had its foundation in the high finance and was built literally and figuratively in the shadow of St. Petronius Church. At the same time, there was something self-pleased and congratulatory in the way in which the mansion held its own amid the changing neighborhood. It almost seemed to be lifted up a little among the tall buildings near at hand, as if it felt the rising value of the land on which it stood. John Waitman was like the house into which he had built himself 30 years ago, and in which his ideals and ambitions were encrusted. He was a self-made man, but in making himself, he had chosen a highly esteemed pattern and worked according to the approved rules. There was nothing irregular, questionable, flamboyant about him. He was solid, correct, and justly successful. His minor tastes, of course, had been carefully kept up to date. At the proper time, pictures by the Barbizon masters, old English plate and portraits, bronzes by Barry, and marbles by Rodin, Persian carpets and Chinese porcelains had been introduced to the mansion. It contained a Louis XV reception room, an Empire drawing room, a Jacobean dining room, and various apartments dimly reminiscent of the style of furniture affected by deceased monarchs. That the hallways were too short for the historic perspective did not make much difference. American decorative art is capable de tout. It absorbs all periods. Of each period, Mr. Waitman wished to have something of the best. He understood its value, present as a certificate and prospective as an investment. It was only in the architecture of his townhouse that he remained conservative, immovable. One might almost say early Victorian Christian. His country house at Dulwich on the Sound was a palace of the Italian Renaissance, but in town he adhered to an architecture which had moral associations, the 19th century brownstone epoch. It was a symbol of his social position, his religious doctrine, and even in a way of his business creed. A man of fixed principles, he would say, should express them in the looks of his house. New York changes its domestic architecture too rapidly. It is like divorce. It is not dignified. I don't like it. Extravagance and fickleness are advertised in most of these new houses. I wish to be known for different qualities. Dignity and prudence are the things that people trust. Everyone knows that I can afford to live in the house that suits me. It is a guarantee to the public. It inspires confidence. It helps my influence. There is a text in the Bible about a house that hath foundations. That is the proper kind of a mansion for a solid man. Harold Waitman had often listened to his father discoursing in this fashion on the fundamental principles of life, and always with a divided mind. He admired immensely his father's talents, and the single-minded energy with which he improved them. But in the paternal philosophy, there was something that disquieted and oppressed the young man and made him gasp inwardly for fresh air and free action. At times, during his college course and his years at the law school, he had yielded to this impulse and broken away, now toward extravagance and dissipation, and then, when the reaction came, toward a romantic devotion to work among the poor. He had felt his father's disapproval for both of these forms of imprudence, but it was never expressed in a harsh or violent way, always with a certain tolerant patience, such as one might show for the mistakes and vagaries of the very young. John Waitman was not hasty, impulsive, inconsiderate, even toward his own children. With them, as with the rest of the world, he felt that he had a reputation to maintain, a theory to vindicate. He could afford to give them time to see that he was absolutely right. One of his favorite scripture quotations was, "Wait on the Lord." He had applied it to real estate and to people with profitable results. But to human persons, the sensation of being waited for is not always agreeable. Sometimes, especially with the young, it produces a vague restlessness, a dumb resentment, which is increased by the fact that one can hardly explain or justify it. Of this, John Waitman was not conscious. It lay beyond his horizon. He did not take it into account in the plan of life which he made for himself and for his family as the sharers and inheritors of his success. "Father plays us," said Harold, in a moment of irritation to his mother, "like pieces in a game of chess." "My dear," said the lady, whose faith in her husband was religious, "you ought not to speak so impatiently. At least he wins the game. He is one of the most respected men in New York, and he is very generous, too." "I wish he would be more generous in letting us be ourselves," said the young man. "He always has something in view for us and expects to move us up to it." "But isn't it always for our benefit?" replied his mother. "Look what a position we have. No one can say there is any taint on our money. There are no rumors about your father. He has kept the laws of God and of man. He has never made any mistakes." Harold got up from his chair and poked the fire. Then he came back to the ample, well-gowned, firm-looking lady and sat beside her on the sofa. He took her hand gently and looked at the two rings, a thin band of yellow gold and a small solitaire diamond, which kept their place on her third finger in modest dignity, as if not ashamed but rather justified by the splendor of the emerald which glittered beside them. "Mother," he said, "you have a wonderful hand, and Father made no mistake when he won you. But are you sure he has always been so inerrant?" "Harold," she exclaimed a little stiffly, "what do you mean? His life is an open book." "Oh," he answered, "I don't mean anything bad, Mother dear. I know the governor's life is an open book, a ledger, if you like, kept in the best bookkeeping hand, and always ready for inspection, every page correct and showing a handsome balance. But isn't it a mistake not to allow us to make our own mistakes, to learn for ourselves, to live our own lives? Must we be always working for the balance in one thing or another? I want to be myself, to get outside of this everlasting profitable plan, to let myself go and lose myself for a while at least, to do the things that I want to do, just because I want to do them." "My boy," said the mother anxiously, "you are not going to do anything wrong or foolish. You know the falsehood of that old proverb about wild oats." He threw back his head and laughed. "Yes, mother," he answered, "I know it well enough. But in California, you know, the wild oats are one of the most valuable crops. They grow all over the hillsides and keep the cattle and the horses alive. But that wasn't what I meant, to sow wild oats. Say, to pick wild flowers, if you like, or even to chase wild geese, to do something that seems good to me just for its own sake, not for the sake of wages of one kind or another. I feel like a hired man in the service of this magnificent mansion, say, in training for Father's place as majordomo. I'd like to get out some way, to feel free, perhaps to do something for others. The young man's voice hesitated a little. Yes, it sounds like can't, I know, but sometimes I feel as if I'd like to do some good in the world, if Father only wouldn't insist upon God's putting it into the ledger. His mother moved uneasily, and a slight look of bewilderment came into her face. Isn't that almost irreverent? She asked. Surely the righteous must have their reward, and your father is good. See how much good he gives to all the established charities, how many things he has founded. He is always thinking of others and planning for them, and surely for us he does everything. How well he has planned this trip to Europe for me and the girls, the court presentation at Berlin, the season on the Riviera, the visits in England with the Plumptons and the Halverstones. He says Lord Halverstone has the finest old house in Sussex, pure Elizabethan, and all the old customs are kept up, too. Family prayers every morning for all the domestics. By the way, you know his son Bertie, I believe. Harold smiled a little to himself as he answered, Yes, I fished at Catalina Island last June with the Honorable Ethelbert. He's rather a decent chap, in spite of his ingrowing mind. But you? Mother, you are simply magnificent. You are Father's masterpiece. The young man leaned over to kiss her and went up to the riding club for his afternoon canter in the park. So it came to pass early in December that Mrs. Waitman and her two daughters sailed for Europe on their serious pleasure trip, even as it had been written in the Book of Providence. And John Waitman, who had made the entry, was left to pass the rest of the winter with his son and heir in the brownstone mansion. They were comfortable enough. The machinery of the massive establishment ran as smoothly as a great electric dynamo. They were busy enough, too. John Waitman's plans and enterprises were complicated, though his principle of action was always simple, to get good value for every expenditure and effort. The banking house of which he was the chief, the brain, the will, the absolutely controlling hand, was so admirably organized that the details of its direction took but little time. But the scores of other interests that radiated from it and were dependent upon it, or perhaps it would be more accurate to say that contributed to its solidity and success, the many investments, industrial, political, benevolent, reformatory, ecclesiastical, that had made the name of Waitman well known and potent in city, church, and state, demanded much attention and careful steering in order that each might produce the desired result. There were board meetings of corporations and hospitals, conferences in Wall Street and at Albany, consultations and committee meetings in the Brownstone Mansion. For a share in all this business and its adjuncts, John Waitman had his son in training in one of the famous law firms of the city, for he held that banking itself is a simple affair. The only real difficulties of finance are on its legal side. Meantime, he wished the young man to meet and know the men with whom he would have to deal when he became a partner in the house. So a couple of dinners were given in the mansion during December, after which the father called the son's attention to the fact that over $100 million had sat around the board. But on Christmas Eve, father and son were dining together without guests, and their talk across the broad table, glittering with silver and cut glass and softly lit by shaded candles, was intimate, though a little slow at times. The elder man was in rather a rare mood, more expansive and confidential than usual, and when the coffee was brought in and they were left alone, he talked more freely of his personal plans and hopes than he had ever done before. "I feel very grateful tonight," said he at last. "It must be something in the air of Christmas that gives me this feeling of thankfulness for the many divine mercies that have been bestowed upon me. All the principles by which I have tried to guide my life have been justified. I've never made the value of this salted almond by anything that the courts would not uphold, at least in the long run. And yet, or wouldn't it be truer to say, and therefore, my affairs have been wonderfully prospered? There's a great deal in the text, honesty is the best, but no, that's not from the Bible after all, is it? Wait a moment. There is something of that kind, I know. May I light a cigar, Father? Said Harold, turning away to hide a smile, while you were remembering the text. Yes, certainly, answered the older man, rather shortly. You know I don't dislike the smell, but it is a wasteful, useless habit, and therefore I have never practiced it. Nothing useless is worthwhile, that's my motto. Nothing that does not bring the reward. Oh, now I recall the text. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. I shall ask Dr. Snodgrass to preach a sermon on that verse some day. Using you as an illustration? Well, not exactly that, but I could give him some good material from my own experience to improve the truth of Scripture. I can honestly say that there is not one of my charities that has not brought me in good return, either in the increase of influence, the building up of credit, or the association with substantial people. Of course, you have to be careful how you give in order to secure the best results. No indiscriminate giving, no pennies in beggars' hats. It has been one of my principles always to use the same kind of judgment in charities that I use in my other affairs, and they have not disappointed me. Even the check that you put in the plate when you take the offertory up the aisle on Sunday morning? Certainly, though there the influence is less direct, and I must confess that I have my doubts in regard to the collection for foreign missions. That always seems to me romantic and wasteful. You never hear from it in any definite way. They say the missionaries have done a good deal to open the way for trade. Perhaps, but they have also gotten us into commercial and political difficulties. Yet I give to them a little. It is a matter of conscience with me to identify myself with all the enterprises of the church. It is the mainstay of social order and a prosperous civilization. But the best forms of benevolence are the well-established, organized ones here at home, where people can see them and know what they are doing. You mean the ones that have a local habitation and a name? Yes, they offer by far the safest return, though of course there is something gained by contributing to general funds. A public man can't afford to be without public spirit. But on the whole, I prefer a building or an endowment. There is mutual advantage to a good name and a good institution in their connection in the public mind. It helps them both. Remember that, my boy. Of course, at the beginning you will have to practice it in a small way. Later you will have larger opportunities, but try to put your gifts where they can be identified and do good all around. You'll see the wisdom of it in the long run. I can see it already, sir, and the way you describe it looks amazingly wise and prudent. In other words, we must cast our bread on the waters in large loaves, carried by sound ships marked with the owner's name, so that the return freight will be sure to come back to us. The father laughed, but his eyes were frowning a little as if he suspected something irreverent under the respectful reply. You put it humorously, but there's sense in what you say. Why not? God rules the sea, but he expects us to follow the laws of navigation and commerce. Why not take good care of your bread, even when you give it away? It's not for me to say why not, and yet I can think of cases. The young man hesitated for a moment. His half-finished cigar had gone out. He rose and tossed it into the fire, in front of which he remained standing, a slender, eager, restless young figure, with a touch of hunger in the fine face, strangely like and unlike the father, at whom he looked with half-wistful curiosity. The fact is, sir, he continued, there is such a case in my mind now, and it is a good deal on my heart, too. So I thought of speaking to you about it tonight. You remember Tom Rollins, the junior who was so good to me when I entered college? The father nodded. He remembered very well, indeed, the annoying incidents of his son's first escapade, and how Rollins had stood by him and helped to avoid a public disgrace, and how a close friendship had grown between the two boys, so different in their fortunes. "Yes," he said, "I remember him. He was a promising young man. Has he succeeded?" "Not exactly. That is, not yet. His business has been going rather badly. He has a wife and little baby, you know. And now he has broken down. Something wrong with his lungs. The doctor says his only chance is a year or 18 months in Colorado. I wish we could help him." "How much would it cost?"
$3,000 or $4,000, perhaps, as a loan.
"Does the doctor say he will get well?"
"A fighting chance, the doctor says."
The face of the older man changed subtly. Not a line was altered, but it seemed to have a different substance, as if it were carved out of some firm, imperishable stuff. "A fighting chance," he said, "may do for a speculation, but it is not a good investment. You owe something to young Rollins. Your grateful feeling does you credit. But don't overwork it. Send him $300 or $400 if you like. You'll never hear from it again, except in the letter of thanks. But for heaven's sake, don't be sentimental. Religion is not a matter of sentiment. It's a matter of principle." The face of the younger man changed now, but instead of becoming fixed and graven, it seemed to melt into life by the heat of an inward fire. His nostrils quivered with quick breath. His lips were curled. "Principle," he said. "You mean principle and interest, too. Well, sir, you know best whether that is religion or not. But if it is, count me out, please. Tom saved me from going to the devil 6 years ago, and I'll be damned if I don't help him to the best of my ability now." John Waitman looked at his son steadily. "Harold," he said at last, "you know I dislike violent language, and it never has any influence with me. If I could honestly approve of this proposition of yours, I'd let you have the money. But I can't. It's extravagant and useless." "But you have your Christmas check for $1,000 coming to you tomorrow. You can use it as you please. I never interfere with your private affairs." "Thank you," said Harold. "Thank you very much. But there's another private affair. I want to get away from this life, this town, this house. It stifles me. You refused last summer when I asked you to let me go up to Grenfell's mission on the Labrador. I could go now, at least as far as the Newfoundland station. Have you changed your mind?"
"Not at all. I think it is an exceedingly foolish enterprise. It would interrupt the career that I have marked out for you."
"Well, then, here's a cheaper proposition. Algy Vanderhoof wants me to join him on his yacht with a little party to cruise on the West Indies. Would you prefer that?"
"Certainly not. The Vanderhoof set is wild and godless. I do not wish to see you keeping company with fools who walk in the broad and easy way that leads to perdition."
"It is rather a hard choice," said the young man with a short laugh, turning toward the door. "According to you, there's very little difference, a fool's paradise or a fool's hell. Well, it's one or the other for me, and I'll toss up for it tonight. Heads, I lose. Tails, the devil wins. Anyway, I'm sick of this, and I'm out of it."
"Harold," said the older man, and there was a slight tremor in his voice, "don't let us quarrel on Christmas Eve. All I want is to persuade you to think seriously of the duties and responsibilities to which God has called you. Don't speak lightly of heaven and hell. Remember, there is another life."
The young man came back and laid his hand upon his father's shoulder. "Father," he said, "I want to remember it.
I try to believe in it. But somehow or other, in this house, it all seems unreal to me. No doubt all you say is perfectly right and wise. I don't venture to argue against it, but I can't feel it, that's all. If I'm to have a soul either to lose or to save, I must really live. Just now, neither the present nor the future means anything to me. But surely we won't quarrel. I'm very grateful to you, and we'll part friends. Good night, sir. The father held out his hand in silence. The heavy portiere dropped noiselessly behind the son, and he went up the wide, curving stairway to his own room. Meantime, John Waitman sat in his carved chair in the Jacobean dining room. He felt strangely old and dull. The portraits of beautiful women by Lawrence and Reynolds and Rayburn, which had often seemed like real company to him, looked remote and uninteresting. He fancied something cold and almost unfriendly in their expression, as if they were staring through him or beyond him. They cared nothing for his principles, his hopes, his disappointments, his successes. They belonged to another world in which he had no place. At this, he felt a vague resentment, a sense of discomfort that he could not have defined or explained. He was used to being considered, respected, appreciated at his full value in every region, even in that of his own dreams. Presently he rang for the butler, telling him to close the house and not to sit up, and walked with lagging steps into the long library, where the shaded lamps were burning. His eye fell upon the low shelves full of costly books, but he had no desire to open them. Even the carefully chosen pictures that hung above them seemed to have lost their attraction. He paused for a moment before an idol of Corot, a dance of nymphs around some forgotten altar in a vaporous glade, and looked at it curiously. There was something rapturous and serene about the picture, a breath of springtime in the misty trees, a harmony of joy in the dancing figures, that wakened in him a feeling of half pleasure and half envy. It represented something that he had never known in his calculated, orderly life. He was dimly mistrustful of it. It is certainly very beautiful, he thought, but it is distinctly pagan. That altar is built to some heathen god. It does not fit into the scheme of a Christian life. I doubt whether it is consistent with the tone of my house. I will sell it this winter. It will bring 3 or 4 times what I paid for it. That was a good purchase, a very good bargain. He dropped into the revolving chair before his big library table. It was covered with pamphlets and reports of the various enterprises in which he was interested. There was a pile of newspaper clippings in which his name was mentioned with praise for his sustaining power as a pillar of finance, for his judicious benevolence, for his support of wise and prudent reform movements, for his discretion in making permanent public gifts. The Waitman charities, one very complacent editor called them, as if they deserved classification as a distinct species. He turned the papers over listlessly. There was a description and a picture of the Waitman wing of the Hospital for Cripples, of which he was president, and an article on the new professor in the Waitman Chair of Political Jurisprudence in Jackson University, of which he was a trustee, and an illustrated account of the opening of the Waitman Grammar School at Dulwich on the Sound, where he had his legal residence for purposes of taxation. This last was perhaps the most carefully planned of all the Waitman charities. He desired to win the confidence and support of his rural neighbors. It had pleased him much when the local newspaper had spoken of him as an ideal citizen and the logical candidate for the governorship of the state. But upon the whole, it seemed to him wiser to keep out of active politics. It would be easier and better to put Harold into the running, to have him sent to the legislature from the Dulwich district, then to the National House, then to the Senate. Why not? The Waitman interests were large enough to need a district representative and guardian at Washington. But tonight, all these plans came back to him with dust upon them. They were dry and crumbling like forsaken habitations. The son upon whom his complacent ambition had rested had turned his back upon the mansion of his father's hopes. The break might not be final, and in any event there would be much to live for. The fortunes of the family would be secure. But the zest of it all would be gone if John Waitman had to give up the assurance of perpetuating his name and his principles in his son. It was a bitter disappointment, and he felt that he had not deserved it. He rose from the chair and paced the room with leaden feet. For the first time in his life, his age was visibly upon him. His head was heavy and hot, and the thoughts that rolled in it were confused and depressing. Could it be that he had made a mistake in the principles of his existence? There was no argument in what Harold had said. It was almost childish, and yet it had shaken the older man more deeply than he cared to show. It held a silent attack which touched him more than open criticism. Suppose the end of his life were nearer than he thought? The end must come sometime. What if it were now? Had he not founded his house upon a rock? Had he not kept the commandments? Was he not touching the law blameless? And beyond this, even if there were some faults in his character, and all men are sinners, yet he surely believed in the saving doctrines of religion, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, the life everlasting. Yes, that was the true source of comfort, after all. He would read a bit in the Bible, as he did every night, and go to bed and to sleep. He went back to his chair at the library table. A strange weight of weariness rested upon him, but he opened the book at a familiar place, and his eyes fell upon the verse at the bottom of the page. Lay not up for yourself treasures upon earth. That had been the text of the sermon a few weeks before. Sleepily, heavily, he tried to fix his mind upon it and recall it. What was it that Dr. Snodgrass had said? Ah, yes, that it was a mistake to pause here in reading the verse. We must read on without a pause. Lay not up your treasures upon earth, where moth and rust do corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. That was the true doctrine. We may have treasures upon earth, but they must not be put into unsafe places, but into safe places. A most comforting doctrine. He had always followed it. Moths and rust and thieves had done no harm to his investments. John Waitman's drooping eyes turned to the next verse at the top of the second column. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. But what had the doctor said about that? How was it to be understood? In what sense, treasures in heaven? The book seemed to float away from him. The light vanished. He wondered if this could be death, coming so suddenly, so quietly, so irresistibly. He struggled for a moment to hold himself up, and then sank slowly forward upon the table. His head rested upon his folded hands. He slipped into the unknown.